Kevin, do we have you on the phone?
You sure do.
Terrific. So let's introduce my guest for today, Dr. Kevin Bacon. And we are going to...
Wait, Kevin Barrett.
Barrett. Right.
No relation to Francis Bacon.
Right, and it would really help if I could read my own handwriting, but we're going to have to work on that some other time. Okay. Kevin, we're going to speak today about what's going on in the world from the perspective of Muslims. What qualifies you to offer your perspectives?
Well, Jabba, I came to Islam back in 1993, and ended up going to school, getting a PhD in Arabic, so I could actually read the Quran and understand the religion from the inside. And I did get that PhD in 2004. Spent a year in Morocco on a Fulbright in 1999-2000, and my PhD does have an Islamology focus. So I've studied Islam from an academic standpoint, which is kind of an outsider standpoint, as well as experienced it from an insider standpoint. And then since 9/11, I've been paying attention to world events and paying attention to the vast discrepancy between what we're seeing in the media here and the reality, and also the vast discrepancy between what we're seeing in the media here and what Muslims all over the world think.
Okay. Clarify one thing for me before we get into this, and that is when I hitchhiked through the Arabic world, I was told that in Arabic, many words can have up to 10 meanings. Is that correct?
Well, sure, but it's the same with English, or many languages have that quality. If you open up the dictionary, especially a really good dictionary in English, you'll see a large number of definitions listed for a lot of words. Arabic might push that a little. There certainly are a lot of words that seem to have a fair number of definitions, but it's not completely in a different universe from English in that regard.
No, I was just thinking of it in terms of the difficulty in Westerners interpreting some of the statements coming out of the Arab world, because if they don't realize that there can be 10 different meanings, they can terribly mistranslate, can't they?
Well, that's true. And that's true of all kinds of translation from one language to another. But the problem with the Arabic translations is that they're often deliberately mistranslated. And one reason for that is that the vast majority of Arabic media that gets translated into English is translated by an outfit called Memri, M-E-M-R-I, which was founded by a couple of allegedly retired Israeli Mossad executives.
Oh.
And it cherry-picks the entire Arab world's media for things that it can spin to make Arabs and Muslims look bad. And in order to make them look bad, it routinely mistranslates.
Convenient.
It certainly is.
Okay. Let's get to current events. From your perspective, what's going on in Yemen?
Well, it looks to me like we have had yet another false flag terror event with this guy, this crotch bomber.
There's no other way to put it.
Yeah. I mean, watch out for those Muslims. Scan their underwear. Give them full body scans and focus particularly on their genitalia, which could be, of course, be ready to explode. they're so potent, those Muslims. Demographically, they're taking over the world. We better scan their genitals and see what they have on us. No, seriously, I think this event, which is being blamed on Yemen, is designed to bring the U.S. into a war in Yemen. Why do U.S. forces want to get to Yemen, or should I say, why does the New World Order want to put U.S. forces in Yemen? I think the answer is that Yemen is a very strategic country that is situated right at the entrance to the Red Sea and controls the shipping through the Suez Canal and the Red Sea, and is right there close to where some of China's oil is coming from. So it's a strategic move. And this crotch bomber was probably a patsy who was set up by Western intelligence agencies in order to get these, 5 days of red alert headlines that have terrorized all of us, some of us at least, into giving up our freedom and going along with this ongoing, bogus war on Islam.
Now, didn't we already control Yemen, or at least control it in the sense that they would do what we wanted and we didn't need to invade? What's changed there?
Well, maybe up to a certain point, but I'm not sure Yemen is quite as firmly in the U.S. camp as Egypt and to a slightly lesser extent, Saudi Arabia. In all of these governments, there are forces that are willing to sell out to the empire. And then there are other forces that want to stand up for the local people. And so the job of the empire is to help out the, what should we call them, the Quislings, you know, the people who are willing to betray their own countries to serve the empire. And to do that, sometimes you have to bring in a whole bunch of imperial stormtroopers. And so you start trouble, you know, you set off terrorist bombs and so on, and then you have an excuse to send in the stormtroopers who then support the forces of empire in that country.
Okay, yeah, that's a standard operating procedure for the last century at least.
Right, right. Well, you know, empire is a pretty old game. It's been going on since, it actually started in the Middle East. In fact, empire and civilization are almost coterminous. You know, the first person who figured out how to build a gangster army, steal the surplus food from the peasants, distribute it to the gangster army, and go out and terrorize more peasants into giving up their grain, and that was the person who founded civilization or life in cities. So it's a very old game. But the U.S. has been getting bigger and nastier at this game since World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we probably studied at the feet of the British, and we've taken over from them. What's going on in Pakistan?
Pretty much the same thing. More false flag terrorism being used as an excuse to strengthen the imperial Quislings and to fight against the local people who don't want the empire to be invading and occupying their country. And there in Pakistan, in fact, it appears that because the U.S. Armed Forces and its paramilitary friends already have a foothold, they're able to go around blowing up mosques and markets just like they've done in Iraq and just like they do in Iran when they can get in there, and, you know, murdering thousands and thousands of innocent civilians and blaming it on supposed Islamist terrorists. But everybody in Pakistan knows that it's really Blackwater and U.S. paramilitaries that are doing this.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the people in Pakistan are not fooled at all, Jamba. There was a poll recently that showed that 97% of people in Pakistan say that Al-Qaeda did not do 9/11. So they understand false flag terror pretty well, and they're getting more and more angry. It's a pretty dangerous situation, actually, because the 3%, the elite that's willing to go along with the empire, is in a pretty precarious position in Pakistan.
I see. So your contention is that when we continually read about Muslim terrorizing other Muslims, the Shiites bombing the Sunni mosques and the Sunnis bombing the Shia mosques, your contention is this is not true and that it's actually covert operations that are stirring up trouble between the two of them and also creating a situation that we see as unrest, so we need to have our troops remain there.
Well, that's right. I would say that a very high proportion of this sectarian violence in the Islamic world is being perpetrated as a result of imperial covert operations, whether by the U.S. or by its proxy or its controller, depending on who you talk to, Israel, which, you know, Israel has a huge covert ops presence in the Arab world. Half of the Israeli population is native Arabic speaking, and they make perfect spies. They sound just like non-Israeli Arabs. Shamba, it's not just that every single bombing is done by these Western paramilitaries, but what happens occasionally is that you'll have the Western paramilitaries start the fight and then sneak out of town and let the sides battle it out.
Right, let revenge take over.
Right.
Okay, that tends to explain quite a bit. One of the things I found fascinating, just as an aside, is that we our drones continually bomb wedding parties and then go, oops, our mistake. And the contention is that these wedding parties have been fingered by other factions within that country, and they just want to bump off rivals, primarily drug rivals. Does that make sense to you?
Well, it makes more sense than any kind of other explanation that these wedding parties are somehow terrorist events. But it's true that the U.S. has been slaughtering civilians shamelessly and seemingly without any kind of scruples or limits in Afghanistan as well as in Pakistan. And you really have to scratch your head and say, you know, why is this? It's not doing any real good to the U.S. cause in these places, at least in the long term. Just recently, Democracy Now! Had an episode discussing this murder of school children in Afghanistan, and it appears that U.S. troops or mercenaries, hard to tell which, just went in at night and dragged these school children out of their beds and shot them in the head. Many were handcuffed first. 8 or 10 of these kids were killed, and you know, all of Afghanistan is in an uproar over this. We're not hearing much about that in our.
I haven't heard anything about that. No.
Well, you could Google it up and watch the Amy Goodman Democracy Now! Segment on it on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, it's the whole, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, all these people, the people there know about this and they don't like it, and it's really amazing how the perspective of people in Islamic countries is completely blacked out in this country. I mean, even if you don't want to agree with them, even if you want to be at war with them, you got to at least, you know what they think.
And that's being denied the American public.
It is. It's a stunning blackout. You know, so often I've been on talk shows and people have called in, and you know, I've been telling people that 9/11 was an inside job for many years now, and they call in and they say, well, of course it couldn't be an inside job because, you know, the Muslims never question it. All the Muslims in the world accept that it was Osama that did it. And I say, excuse me, let me show you some poll results that show that upwards from anywhere from 3/4 to well over 90% of the world's Muslims say it was an inside job. And they say, really? I never saw that. Yeah, uh-huh. That's the reason you never saw that. The media won't publish it.
I see. Okay, let's switch focus slightly. What's your take on the U.S. Supposedly closing down Guantanamo and these trials that they're going to have in New York City?
Oh, glad you asked that, because I co-wrote a very, very extensive point-by-point discussion and refutation of the list of overt acts and the charges against these defendants that they're charging with 9/11. And that actually just got posted today on What Really Happened, and it's about to get posted on Rents, so it's going to suddenly get a much bigger audience, even though we posted it a couple of weeks ago. And people can read that at truthjihad.com. But it's quite pathetic that you know, Obama promised to shut down Guantanamo, and you know, he was talking peace. You know, I would have expected that there was a chance that the whole mythical war on terror would have been over if Obama had been the guy that we all voted for, or at least many of us voted for. I voted for McKinney, but all my friends voted for Obama.
Yep.
So he's been breaking promises left and right. You know, one theory is that he's a controlled asset of the same financial powers that run the whole show behind the scenes. Another theory is that he doesn't want to go the way that JFK went when he took on the military-industrial complex. And, you know, maybe it's some combination thereof, but in any case, these show trials of these guys who are being charged with 9/11 are probably intended to persuade the American public that the official story of 9/11 is correct, and there's a slight chance they could backfire if these guys get lawyers who are willing to actually defend them, but I suppose the government has gone to great lengths to make sure that that won't happen.
I think the best example of what will probably happen is the recent thing where a federal judge, I believe it was in New York, threw out the charges against the Blackwater guys that killed the 17 people in Afghanistan. And all it takes is one federal judge on the take to throw out the charges, and that's the end of it.
And the federal judges are mostly on the take these days. I've discussed the situation with people like Francis Boyle, who's an international law professor at the University of Illinois, and he, you know, he's done a lot of civil resistance cases where people go and, you know, try to throw blood on missiles and get arrested and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And now he says that you just can't get any kind of hearing in the federal courts because so many of the judges that have been appointed are just absolute corrupt, you know, mafia, basically. There's really a behind-the-scenes money mafia that has largely taken over the country, and these federal judges apparently are mostly card-carrying members of that mafia, so, you're never going to get any justice through the federal courts, or so I hear.
This is what I've heard and read as well, and this goes back for quite a number of years. I think it came out of an organization called the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society is a society of lawyers, and supposedly administrations for the past three or four administrations have only appointed judges from the Federalist Society. So it's not as if these guys are corrupted once they're in office. They've been put in office in the first place because they were already corrupt.
That's right, and corrupt in a particular way. This Federalist Society looks to be pretty much a neoconservative organization.
Yes.
And the neoconservatives are people who have inherited a Nazi philosophy by way of, the original Nazi philosopher was Carl Schmitt, and his leading student was Leo Strauss, a German Jew, who then fled Nazi Germany with his Nazi philosophy, which was actually even more extreme and brutal than Schmitt's, and set up shop at the University of Chicago and brought this Nazi might makes right, big lies are great kind of philosophy to America, and trained a whole cult of neoconservatives in this this psychopathic philosophy, and I think it's infected the judiciary through the Federalist Society.
Yeah, and they've been very successful in seeding the judiciary to the extent that they have that many of the sitting judges are appointed by them under their sway. And the government could move a trial around. If they get a judge they don't like, they think up some excuse and move the trial. And the best example I can think of was the trial of Timothy McVeigh, which was moved from Oklahoma up to Denver because they had a very compliant judge up there, and that was the end of that.
That's right. With the 9/11 defendants trial, assuming it happens, the only chance for something interesting to come out of that would be if the defendants get genuine legal representation from somebody who is courageous and willing to try to give them a defense, because there's so much exculpatory evidence that proves that, you know, there's absolutely no case whatsoever against these guys. And if you go and read the actual overt acts in the charges against them, it's a joke. I urge people to check it out at the website truthjihad.com and look at this ridiculous set of allegations against these guys. I mean, well over a third of the allegations don't even mention any of these people who are on trial. It's just stuff like, back in 1995, Osama bin Laden declared war on the U.S. So that's supposed to be an overt act committed by one of the defendants.
That's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah. And it goes on like that.
Yeah. Well, and the government is getting famous for that sort of thing. It was Jose Padilla, which they were accusing of all sorts of things, and when they finally took him to court, the indictment against him had nothing to do with what they'd been accusing him of all those times, all that time.
Right, and by then he was a human vegetable who'd been tortured into loss of his soul, or whatever you want to call it, and mm-hmm. he was in no condition to defend himself. And that's a pretty scary kind of legal situation when habeas corpus gets thrown out. You know, it's been around for centuries, and now they can just disappear people without charging them with anything, without presenting any evidence, without putting them on trial, and then they can torture them and destroy their minds. And once somebody's been tortured to the point of breaking down, they're never going to be the same person. They will probably, at least they're vulnerable to parroting whatever the torturer has instilled in them. That's what torture does. It's not about getting true information from people. It's about breaking people down and forcing them to accept whatever belief system you want to inflict on them.
And so, say whatever you want them to say.
That's right.
Just don't torture me.
Right. And once you've broken them, they'll stick with whatever you've imprinted on them. And so it wouldn't surprise me if these guys on trial who may have had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with 9/11, mm-hmm. They probably were convinced that they did have something to do with 9/11 by their torturers. And so now they're going to be out there, bragging about it or confessing, and it'll be perfect for the show trial. And the problem is their attorneys may not be willing to look at the evidence that proves that they didn't have anything to do with it.
I see. Okay, we've got a call. You willing to entertain callers?
I'd love to.
Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hello, this sounds like my cousin Kevin. This is David Edwards.
David Edwards, hey, how are you doing?
I'm living in Nevada City now.
That's what I heard. Yeah, you know, I might be coming out to visit you guys. I'm planning a speaking tour of Sacramento and the Bay Area, and I'm sure I'll have to get up there and see your new place.
Hot damn! Anyway, back to the show. Something I like to point out with people is that the Trade Center bombing is not a conspiracy theory. It's a matter of physics. The building was dynamited. The conspiracy theory is who did it.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. Although I'd say it was thermited rather than dynamited.
Well,
yeah,
you can use whatever term you want. The building was brought down by mechanical means with explosives.
Controlled demolition.
Airplanes.
Controlled demolition.
Yeah.
Yep.
And
that's pretty well established.
Well, there's no question about it that you can't get a building to fall down in free fall by hitting it with an airplane.
Right. And David, you have some experience, working with physical objects. You're not just, talking off out of the top of your head here, right?
Well, I was an engineering contractor for 20 years.
Okay.
So, yes, that's true.
And so, how long did it take you to figure out that these were controlled demolitions, David?
Well, I thought about it about 3 seconds after I heard the initial broadcast, but it wasn't until I heard that guy, the architect who was doing the speaking tour, who said he was driving through Arizona, and it dawned on him that they were in free fall. And it hadn't dawned on me until I heard him say it.
Well, that was Richard Gage, probably.
Richard,
right?
Yeah, that's the one. And then it all clicked in. I always believed that it was an inside job, but I didn't actually have the proof in my mind until I realized that it was in free fall.
Guys, I'm going to have to interrupt here because I've done numerous shows on 9/11.
Oh, good.
I think my listeners are pretty up to speed on that, and we do have another caller.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Okay, thank you for your call. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Yes, I have a question regarding the Iranian nuclear possibilities and our objections to it.
Terrific.
Okay, Israelis have had nukes since 1974. They had nuclear or biological weapons shortly thereafter. They've had those missiles pointed at their neighbors. So anyone taking up arms against them is doing so defensively to a degree. So why, the entire world knows that Israel has these weapons, except that you can't talk about it in the U.S. because of Alan Dershowitz and his gang.
Okay.
We'll jump on you.
Okay.
But why doesn't the Muslim community, or even the Iranians specifically, bring this up over and over and over to, why isn't Israel being, why don't we have sanctions against Israel? Why don't we...
Or more to the point, why aren't we allowed to create these weapons in defense because our enemy already has them.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
And I don't know if he has any insight into that.
Let's find out.
Sure.
Okay. Kevin?
Sure. This is the same situation as with, the fact that the vast majority of the world's Muslims say 9/11 was an inside job. Likewise, not only virtually all of the world's Muslims, but all of the leaders of all of the Muslim countries, even the ones that are pretty much under U.S. occupation or U.S. Puppets, are saying this. They're all saying that, we're living in the shadow of this Israeli sword of Damocles. It's hanging over our heads, with a very thin frayed thread holding it up there. And if some other country in this region doesn't get nuclear weapons, we could be just killed and destroyed. Our whole, all the Arab capitals are targeted and could be gone in 10 minutes. We need to stop nuclear proliferation in this region by getting rid of all of the nuclear weapons, and Israel is the only country that has any. And so the leaders of all these countries have said this over and over and over, one way or another. The Iranians are saying it over and over and over. They keep presenting proposals for a denuclearized Middle East at every chance they get. And so once again, the problem isn't that the Muslims are not saying this. The problem is that it's not being reported in the corporate mainstream media, And that is probably both because the corporate mainstream media is controlled by a very small number of people with a huge CIA influence. And then, and this is taboo in some quarters to mention, but the fact that the Jewish percentage in the key decision-making positions, both in ownership and administration and down to the level of reporters, is very, very out of whack with the 2% population of Jews in this country. I had somebody on my show, Philip Weiss, a Jewish guy, former reporter for the New York Times, who wrote a very powerful and courageous blog entry on this called Do Jews Control the Media and So What If We Do? You can Google that up. It's a great read. And he says that, his estimate would be well over 50% of the people that, in his career he worked for and with are Jewish, and that virtually all of them have been conditioned from an early age to be reflexive supporters of Israel. And even if it's not a conspiracy, but it's just a matter of your worldview. And if we had 60% of the key people in the U.S. media that were Muslims, I can tell you that every single day we would hear that 9/11 was an inside job. Every single day we would hear that the Israelis are the only nuclear threat in the Middle East, that they're the most aggressive and murderous country on earth, and on and on and on. We would get a whole different picture of the world. I think it does matter, and we should talk about the fact that we have such a tremendous overrepresentation of Jewish people with their particular perspective in the corporate mainstream media.
Okay, I think you've established that point. I have a question. The opinion that I've been given, and this is probably given by mainstream media, is I never hear, when I hear the Iranians' reasons for wanting nuclear capability, it's always in terms that they want to develop their nuclear reactors so that they're not dependent on oil. And this makes no sense to me whatsoever because they already have tons of oil. They don't need nuclear for electricity. But I'm not reading or hearing that the reason that they want nuclear is for weapons as a deterrent to Israel.
The official position of the Iranian government is that they want to develop nuclear power in order to be self-sufficient in energy as the age of oil comes to an end. And the estimates of when that will happen range from, well, some people say that within a decade we will be into severe peak oil economic collapse globally, and others say that no, we're not going to be into a peak oil situation for several decades. But either way, it takes a while to build up a big-time nuclear power generation capacity. And so the Iranians may very well be telling the truth that their main objective is to prepare for the post-oil world. But at the same time, they may very well also have noticed that North Korea has fallen off the radar, even though they did build and test and deploy nuclear weapons, which is supposedly this horrible crime that Iran is being accused of. But yet once, once a country gets nuclear weapons like Israel has or like North Korea has, then nobody seems to care anymore, and that country becomes immune to attack. So maybe the Iranians, who surely know that everybody in the Middle East wishes that other countries there would develop nuclear weapons in order to prevent the Israelis from nuking them unpunished. The more countries in the Middle East that get nuclear weapons, the less likely that Israel is going to nuke somebody.
Kevin, how realistic a threat is that? Because that one doesn't hold water for me, because the Israelis have had nuclear weapons for decades now, and they haven't used them. Why should the Arabs be afraid that suddenly they're going to start nuking Arab capitals? That makes no sense.
Because the Israelis are so rapidly out of control in terms of the way that they slaughter Arab people with absolutely no respect for human life. There was that British Medical Journal article a few years ago that showed that 600 children within a space of a couple of years had been shot dead by Israeli snipers as they played in schoolyards and walked down the sidewalks and so on. Nobody's ever been prosecuted for any of that. That's just one small example of outrageous.
I will grant that within the borders of Israel, the Israelis are behaving abysmally and atrociously against the Muslims living there and the Arabs.
No, they kill people all over the earth.
Okay.
If somebody gets killed, I have friends who teach in places like in the Gulf.
Okay.
And they say that, you know, people say, oh, are you worried about terrorism? And they say, no, as long as you don't, you know, say anything bad about the Mossad, you'll be okay. If you get the Mossad mad at you, you're dead. I mean, they run around the world slaughtering people like there's no tomorrow. They probably kill more people than every other intelligence agency on Earth combined.
I see. And this is throughout the Arab world?
Yes. Including Morocco, where I've lived. I was on a Fulbright in Morocco. I got to meet some of the embassy-level people.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to meet the leader of the Jewish community in Morocco. Well, it just so happens that what I've learned through my many Moroccan contacts is that the royal family in Morocco is protected by the Mossad, and the Israeli Mossad, with some help from the Americans, has built the torture chambers there. And, you know, they were the ones who ethnic cleansed Morocco, forced all the Jews in Morocco, or a lot of them, to leave and go to Israel. I mean, the Mossad just runs rampant in Morocco, and the Moroccan people hate it. And the same thing is true to a greater or lesser degree throughout the Arab world.
Okay. We've got another caller. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Yes. Hi. Have a great program.
Thank you.
Your guest name, is it Kevin or Devin? I'm having trouble.
Kevin.
Kevin. I have a question for him. I'm assuming when he refers, when he uses the term the empire, he's talking about the multinational corporations and not just necessarily the U.S. and its interests. But my question is, taking it out of the Jewish-Islamic question, I'm more interested in looking at it this way. I've done a little research on my own. There's between 1.5 and 2 billion Muslims in the world, and a lot of them are in poor countries that are trying to develop, sitting on untapped natural resources. And my question is this demonization of Islam really about getting access to natural resources in a world where there's dwindling supply? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, that's a very, very good question. And yes, I do think that the empire is more one of multinational corporations and financiers than just U.S. national interests. In fact, a lot of what's been going on is certainly not in the interest of the average American.
Yeah, I would underscore that. I think that most of what's going on is in the interests of the international financial empire, and definitely not in the interests of America.
Well, that's right. And as far as demonizing Islam in order to get access to the resources in a world where those resources may become more and more precious, I think that's very likely the case. It's hard to tell for sure, you know, somebody like me who's not really an expert, to what extent we're facing, you know, sort of an imminent, you know, peak oil problem and, you know, an imminent energy problem. But there has to be a major sort of energy and environmental crisis coming down the pipe. You know, whether it, you know, how bad it gets, how soon, I don't really know. But I do agree that this destabilization of the oil-producing parts of the Islamic world, you know, does make it easier for the imperial forces to make sure that there won't be enough organized local resistance that could prevent outsiders from coming in and getting those resources on their terms. Now, Saddam Hussein, for all of his faults, did develop Iraqi oil to benefit the Iraqi people, and the Iraqi people were getting up towards Western living standards. The technology was advanced, education was advanced, medicine was doing real well. You know, the overall picture was getting real close to U.S. European standard of living. And then
not only that, but the women in Iraq probably had greater freedom than any other Muslim country.
They did, and there was a pretty good interconfessional truth, or rather peace, between the different religions, and people were not persecuted on the basis of sect. And I do think that the empire likes to divide and conquer by sparking little miniature Hatfield-McCoy type feuds between the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Christians.
Hey, it works.
Yeah.
It works real well.
On the other hand, though, couldn't they just buy the resources from a more stable country? And that's where you have to wonder whether the Zionism angle is not important, because, you know, we theoretically, you know, the U.S. could offer the Islamic oil-producing world a kind of a deal on terms of somewhat more equality, and basically set up an oil for protection arrangement. Protection, of course, against the Russians and the Chinese, who are the two big powers, and India to a certain extent.
You know, I thought of that in terms of the Arab-Israeli conflict within Israel as well. For all of the money that the United States has spent on the Israeli military so that they can persecute the Palestinians, they could buy the Palestinians, they could buy every one of them an estate on the French Riviera.
But why should they, since that money is coming from the U.S. taxpayer, and the whole rationale is to protect the poor Israelis against those evil Arabs who want to drive them into the sea?
Send all of the Palestinians to the French Riviera. Or, with desalinization technology, they could create a French Riviera on the Red Sea.
Well, that's a plan. You know, or here's another plan. How about let's say that you agree that there has to be a Jewish state.
Okay.
Even though, you know, the vast majority of the world's 3,000 plus ethnic groups don't have their own state. In fact, hardly anybody has an ethnic state. But let's just say the Jews do deserve one. Let's put that Jewish state not in Alaska, as Ahmadinejad facetiously suggested. Why not just put it in New York, which is already pretty much a Jewish state? There are more Jews in New York City than there are in Israel. Not just the city. So just move all the Israeli Jews to New York, and the state of New York will become a Jewish state, and that would be great, wouldn't it?
Let's have another caller. Before we have another caller, I'm late in letting people know that you're listening to KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chambalain. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing, and we have as our guest today Kevin Barrett. Okay. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hi there. Hey, another big factor to me has always seemed to be that the Quran doesn't allow usury, and I think that makes the banks really nervous.
Yes, and I've asked this question before: is that if Islamic banks do not charge interest, how do they make their money? I'm a little suspicious of that. The Quran may say that, but I'm not sure that's the reality.
In today's world, I think most of the Islamic banks either charge interest or they have something that ends up being pretty much the equivalent of interest. But historically, there was a different kind of economy in the world of Islam, which, you know, there was always some lending of interest, but that was by gangsters. It was, you know, it was a criminal activity, sort of like drugs and prostitution are now. And good people didn't do it. So what did good people do? Well, if you made more money than you could use, you could set up a pious foundation, which is a waqf, or you could lend your money interest-free to your friends and relatives, which was highly regarded, or you could give away your money, which was highly regarded. It was kind of a potlatch culture where your prestige depends on how much you give away, not how much you have. So it's in this modern dog-eat-dog culture that interest has become a key feature of our economy. But I'm not sure that it will always be, because especially, you know, the creation of money by banks, private banks, at interest, with nothing backing that money, has worked okay for the last century or two. But in a world where the growth is going to have to slow down and perhaps reverse, we may end up in a negative growth world in our lifetimes. This will be mathematically unsustainable, and we may have to go back to a world where lending at interest doesn't make sense, and in fact, and especially creating currency at interest doesn't make sense.
Okay, and in that case, our caller's supposition was correct.
Well, yeah, I think Eddie's right. I think that there are many cultural barriers in the Islamic world to penetration by the corporatist empire, and this is one of them.
Okay. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hello. I had a comment. You guys were talking about the Mossad.
Right.
And I was thinking, well, if someone blew up the Twin Towers, it was probably them, because I don't think our CIA would do it. Know what I mean?
Okay, that's an opinion.
Or it's a possibility, at least.
Sure.
If you look at the videos, 9/11 Mysteries, they really give some good evidence about that. Really incontrovertible, in my opinion.
Yep. Yeah, and one thing to consider is you're making a separation and a distinction between the Mossad and the CIA.
Yeah.
That may not be so.
Well, you might be right, too. Who knows? But,
okay. All right. Thanks for your comment.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of evidence pointing in that general direction. Larry Silverstein, who's notorious for having confessed to the apparent controlled demolition of Building 7,
right,
and who made $750 million on that demolition alone, plus billions more on the other buildings, which he bought just a month and a half before 9/11 and overinsured. And of course,
That was nice and convenient.
Yeah. So I mean, all of your listeners by now probably know that Larry Silverstein is, to say the least, a person of interest in the 9/11 investigation, and he does have links with this right wing in Israel. Mm-hmm. He's a weekly telephone buddy of Benjamin Netanyahu, and his partner in developing the World Trade Center, Frank Lowy, is another kind of arch Zionist billionaire financier. And there's all sorts of other evidence, too, pointing towards the likelihood of Israeli involvement in the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center. And if people want to find out about that, they can go to Christopher Bolin's website, B-O-L-L-Y-N. Just Google him up, go to his website, and his book is free online. So read his book. It's a very important 9/11 book, and he's put it online for people to read it. Bolin,
great.
B-O-L-L-Y-N.
Okay. Ready for next call. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hi. I just wanted to touch on the hand that the Illuminati plays in all this conflict, and one of their gurus, Albert Pike, in the prediction of his three world wars to bring about a one world order. And I could quote, the first two came to fruition just like he had said before they took place, and the third world war is to be fomented by taking advantage of the differences caused by the agents of the Illuminati between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. He goes on to say, but talk about his hand and what he has to do with this conflict.
Okay.
And I was looking at the globe, and it was interesting that Washington, D.C., the Federal Zone, and the State of Israel, which took place after the League of Nations or the World War II, where you're talking about Britain picked up and we picked up their tactics. And then Britain is, it creates like a triangle, and Britain's at the top, just like the pyramid goes on and on
mm-hmm.
and on. All right,
okay.
Good day.
Thank
great
you for your comment.
Okay, bye.
Yep. You want to comment on that, Kevin?
Well, there aren't really enough specifics in that particular caller's description of this alleged Illuminati conspiracy for me to really say much about it. But that's an interesting subject. I've read a little bit about it, and it's a lot harder to be sure exactly what's going on with this kind of a large nebulous conspiracy than it is to know what's going on with things like 9/11 being a war trigger, false flag event, and so on. But if anybody wants to contact me with information about how I can actually have a more specific sense of mm-hmm. what this Illuminati conspiracy entails, I'm always willing to look at it.
If people wanted to contact you, how would they do so?
They can do that through my website, which, as I said, is truthjihad.com.
Okay, and jihad is J-I-H-A-D.
That's right.
Truthjihad.com.
Right.
Okay, we had another caller. We have another caller. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Yeah, hi, Chamba. Great show.
Thank you.
I'd like the speaker to talk a little about what he understands the long-range goals of the Zionists. And the reason I bring this up is that I have read that many Zionists look to the scriptures to basically say that Israel should contain all or most of the Middle East. So if you could talk about that a bit, because I think that's the big, elephant in the room, as people like to say, as to why a lot of things are happening.
Okay.
So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Kevin?
Well, there certainly are a number of Zionists out there who want Israel to take over everything from the Nile to the Euphrates, and that's the scriptural reference, I think, that the caller was talking about. Yes, there's a strong element that is following that kind of biblical Zionism, and for them, keeping these wars going serves their purposes. If they were to just settle down and make peace on the kind of terms that the Palestinians and their neighbors could accept, they'd be, stuck in lesser Israel, and these people want greater Israel. And that's why they launched the War of Aggression in 1967 and stole Jerusalem, which had been an Islamic holy city since Islam began, really, for nearly a millennium and a half. And there's no indication that these people are not going to continue to keep the keep the pot boiling and keep preparing for an even bigger war in the future and keep stealing more land until they get everything from the Nile to the Euphrates. Of course, there are people in Israel who don't agree with that. There are, you know, other kinds of Zionists there, and there are even anti-Zionists now among the Jewish community in Israel. But overall, this tendency of these messianic kinds of Zionists who believe that God has given them a real estate deed in perpetuity, these people are really dangerous. And I do think that the caller is right. This is the elephant in the living room in terms of what's been going on for the past 10 years in this country.
I'd like to give my opinion at this point. My opinion is that those rabid Zionists that want more territory are being used. And I think that they're being used by the internationalists that really want to control the world's resources. Now, Kevin, you and I have both been in that part of the world, and most of it's sand. I don't think the Zionists really want more sand. What they want is political and economic control over resources. I think if there wasn't oil there, it would be an entirely different equation. But I think they're using these militant xenophobic Zionists to further their aims. I don't think it's about territory per se.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of the picture. You know, everybody is kind of using everybody. The resource people are using the arch Zionists, and the arch Zionists are using the resource people. Everybody is, you know, sort of pursuing their own goals. But I think you shouldn't underestimate this desire among some of the Zionists to fulfill biblical prophecy and to build up and expand a powerful Jewish state for ideological reasons, not purely because they just want resources. Everybody wants resources, but there are a million ways of making sure that you individually have enough resources to get by, and there are a million ways to, you know, increase your company's wealth. And I think that without this expansionist Zionist presence in Palestine, we would be getting our resources from the Middle East in a far more peaceful way.
Okay. Do you think that these people are crazy enough? I mean, they're already locked in a war with Muslims that are living inside of their present borders. If their expansionist, wildest wet dreams came true, and they controlled from the Nile to the Euphrates, wouldn't they simply exacerbate that problem, that they would now have millions more of Muslim Arabs living within their borders that would be in restlessness and foment? It would seem to me that that would be the last thing that they'd want.
Yeah, I would agree if they're rational, and
okay,
also, you know, and if they're thinking in terms of the near-term future. But if they're fanatically committed to this vision and they're thinking in the long term, and they're looking at a world that's running out of resources and a part of the world that's running out of water, they may very well be thinking that if we keep, you know, these small, you know, keep making these small steps, grabbing little bits of territory here, grabbing Lebanon, they might grab Lebanon's water tomorrow for all we know. They seem to be gearing up to do that. And, you know, as war, the fog of war is a perfect excuse for grabbing more territory for ethnic cleansing people. So, I mean, I would think their end game would be to expel all of the Palestinians from the entire, you know, area, and kill many of them, and then kill and or expel many of the people in what they think should be Greater Israel, and that this would be a long-term plan.
Okay, I see. All right, we're just about out of time. Take a few minutes, and do you have anything to say in summation?
Sure. You know, I hope people will try to look at the other side that never gets reported in the mainstream. And even the alternative media in this country doesn't give much shrift to the Islamic majority view of these matters. So please check it out. If you go to my website, truthjihad.com, there are links to Muslims for 9/11 Truth, which is just getting up and going as a more active organization now. And also check out the foreign press, places like Press TV and Al-Manar, which is the Hezbollah news organization. Check out places like that, and you'll see a somewhat different picture from the one that you're getting from MSNBC.
Okay. Kevin, thanks very much for being our guest today.
Thanks, Shamba. It's been fun.
Okay. Have yourself a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right. That was Kevin Bacon. Kevin Barrett. Very sorry.